Hello there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and today I am joined by my father, Dr. Scott Keith. Unfortunately, we're doing a little bit of a re-recording today. I'll just tell people that this episode was originally recorded with Rod down in San Clemente. I got home, and there was an issue with the audio from that recording that sort of wasn't salvageable. So we are re-recording the second episode of the Catechism, unfortunately without Rod, and we're going to see how this goes. I'm sure it'll be fine. We were able to do the first episodes just fine, but it is always fun to be able to record with Rod now, even though it's been a little more difficult in the last year, and we do have plans to be heading down the hill a little more frequently now, and so Rod should be joining us for more of these episodes. All right, Dad, so last episode, we made it into the fourth commandment. We made it, so we did an introduction. We went over the preface of the small catechism. We did first three commandments. We in the last 5 minutes, snuck in, thou shalt honor your father and mother.
Yep.
Very fitting. Now, in this second episode, I'm violating that by making you record an episode of the Breakfast Fellows. And
that doesn't bother me.
And so now we got to move on. So fifth commandment is where we're picking up here. And this is, to me, the turn. I said this, I think last time too. This is the turn where sometimes in particular commandments, you can start thinking you're doing a really good job.
Right. Oh, yeah, because it seems easy to not murder somebody.
Right.
Yeah. Or at least doable.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, I don't know what percent, it's probably over 98, 99% of the population, right, doesn't have murder charges.
Well, that's funny. I don't know. I would hope it's close to 99%.
Yeah, me too. I don't know, but, you know, everybody walking, you know, I would say most people just walking around, most people you work with,
yeah,
I would hope everybody you work with
aren't
convicted murderers. Yeah. And so this seems like maybe the commandment where everybody just looks at each other and goes, good job.
Yeah, good it job. Does seem that way until you run into Jesus, who tells you that any time you've hated a person, or deeply hated a person in your heart, you've murdered against them in the eyes of God. Luther, in his explanation to the fifth commandment, he goes deeper, right, than just thou shalt not murder some random person. But he also doesn't go quite as deep as Christ did in the explanation of this commandment. Where Luther is, I mean, let's back up for a second. We've talked about the first table of the law and the second table of the law as it's sort of broken up here in the small catechism. And the fourth commandment was our first foray into that second table. That table has to do with how God wants us to treat those people whom he has called into our lives. That fourth commandment, we said, is very specific. It seems like it's dealing with the people, the direct people that God has put in our lives, parents specifically. As Luther explains it, it goes out a little wider than that. But we can have this tendency to jump into the fifth commandment and say, hey, this is the one where God is calling us to a certain type of behavior towards the whole world. In that he's saying don't murder, and he's saying don't murder anyone, right? But the reality is here is that the same thing holds true here, where this is really has to do with the people that God has called into your lives. And I think I said this in the first recording. I should stop doing this. I'm trying to remember all the things I said in the first recording.
Yeah, just let it flow.
Yeah.
It's a different setting.
But you are most likely in any of these commandments to sin against those people who are right next to you, right? Yeah. It's kind of easy to say, don't murder some guy in Sri Lanka, especially since you'll probably never go to Sri Lanka. You might even be able to pull that one off in your heart because you're never going to meet them. But the reality is that up close, that's going to be the people up close to you, the people that God has put directly in your lives. They're the ones that you're going to love the most. They're the ones that you're going to frustrate you the most. And they're the ones that you're going to be most tempted to sin against in every commandment, and this one too.
Yeah, I think if we take Jesus' explanation from the Sermon on the Mount that you took and extrapolate even farther than here into, I mean, you could take Luther's explanation of endangering and harm into hate. It would, in sure. a sense, still be acting on that hate. But it even means you can act on that hate in a way that's indirect to your neighbor to cause harm too, right? You could incite violence against them by other people.
Well, Luther's explanation very much focuses on bodily here. He says we should fear and love God that we do not hurt nor harm our neighbor in their body. Mm-hmm. Well, my point is that he's talking about your neighbor. Now, your neighbor can extend out to the whole world, but likely the people that are your neighbor, the ones that you encounter the most, are going to be the ones that are closest to you. You're going to start at your family, going to go to your coworkers, going to go to your friends, going to go to your actual neighbors, people that live in your neighborhood, going to go to the people that live in your city, the people that live in your county, the people that live in your state. I mean, the further out you get, the harder it is going to be, really, for you to hurt or harm somebody in their body, or on the flip side of that, help and befriend them in every bodily need.
Right.
And so, as Luther's explaining this to, he's explaining it to the people of his time, most of whom will never travel outside their village.
Yeah, that's
or their city,
and are probably not really even aware of a lot of the other people out there, right? Past a certain,
they might be in this context because they are a little, afraid of the invasion from the Muslim Turks.
But they don't know their names. I think
they don't know their names.
One of the things is like social media is a great one to see why our society would have a harder time gripping with some of these explanations, because everybody's your neighbor.
Theoretically,
but you know, it feels like the things people post or say or do on social media that may be 2,000 miles away happened in your living room.
Happened in your living room and or hurt you and or help you, I suppose. Either way. And so this is, in our age, this is a little more difficult or to wrap your head around because we communicate so broadly with people everywhere.
Yeah.
And so we really can hurt people
that
are 3,000 miles away pretty easily. We really can help people that are 3,000 miles away pretty easily. But I think at the end of the day, it holds true that most likely the people that you will help or hurt the most are the people right next to you. And this commandment against murder is meant to protect society as a whole and also meant to protect sort of the relationships that keep things going and the life of somebody that God knew since before they were born.
Yeah. Yeah, there's, again, that added positive aspect, which is on the end of all of these, which is, if you're not hurting and harming them, what are you supposed to do? Right?
Help and befriend them.
And that's help and befriend in this instance.
Now, I think it's interesting to point out that helping them and befriending them, their bodily meat, protecting them, right? In their body, that's something we don't think about a whole lot, right? That it's maybe our obligation to physically help our neighbor, to protect them, maybe even physically.
Yeah.
That's something we don't think about a lot, but I think it was intended here. It was intended to say, listen, there are two parts to this, and the one part might mean putting yourself at risk for the sake of your neighbor.
Right. Yeah. And I think that helps go into the explanation of later, you know, can soldiers be saved? Can people who whose job literally involves killing?
Yeah, well, that was the question. If you're saying that it's against God's law to kill, the question automatically comes up, what about sort of justified killing and or what about being a soldier? And Luther answers that in his treatise regarding can soldiers be saved. And he answers affirmatively, of course they can, because, you know, part of their calling on this earth is to befriend and defend their neighbor in the role of soldier. And so, yeah, that being a valid calling, of course they can be saved because at times they will be called upon to kill as part of who they are as a soldier.
Yeah. All right. So the sixth commandment. You shall not commit adultery.
Yeah. Again, I think for a lot of people, this is like
pat on the back.
Got that one.
Right. Especially if you go really hyper literal with adultery.
Yeah.
You know, if you're not married.
Yeah.
Right.
I think a lot of people can say that they have feel like they have success over this simply just by virtue of not being married and not cheating on their spouse.
Yeah.
And I think that what Luther does here is he clarifies that this has to do overall with your approach to your neighbor in their sexuality and in your sexuality. In other words, that you're supposed to be chaste and decent is the old, that we ought to lead a chaste and decent life. And that chaste means, I think, respecting another person so as not to take advantage of them in a sexual way. More sort of specifically defined is that the act of having a sexual relationship with somebody else is intended in marriage alone.
Right. Yeah. And here positively put is love and honoring your spouse.
Right. And so that's when you get the flips. And that's when you get the clarification of that. So lead this chaste and decent life. And one might ask, how do I do that? Yeah. And the answer is love and honor your spouse. Well, the implication there is that your sexuality will be expressed through a marital relationship, and that you love your spouse, you know, you keep them dear, you protect them, and you honor them and yourself, really, by not violating that relationship,
right.
and keeping it, keeping that expression of your love between just you and your spouse.
Right, and that's, you know, it really highlights that in adultery, it is you're actually harming somebody else. This isn't just a selfish act where it's sort of existentially bad because
this is damaging. In fact, I'd say,
well, there's some reports out there that say like children of divorce end up being worse off than like children who have death in the family.
Oh,
because
yeah.
It is, or at least in a psychological way, as bad in many ways because the family dies. That family is separated, and adultery is one of those large causes of separation of the family being destroyed.
Yeah, and the thing is, I mean, this is anecdotal on my part, but what I've seen through relationships that have ended because of infidelity, and it's just hurtful across the board. I think I've told the story on here before about after my dad died, we moved to my mom's hometown, and there were some really close family relationships there, and my grandpa died. And then after that, the sort of main sort of fatherish relationship I had was with an uncle of mine that was married to my mom's sister. And their marriage ended in divorce, and it ended lots of reasons, but infidelity was part of it. And that was damaging not just to my aunt and uncle and not just to my aunt and uncle and my cousins, but that was very damaging and hurtful to the entire extended family. You know, my aunt, my uncle, my cousins, me, my brother, my mom, my grandmother, my other cousin from the other marriage that that particular uncle was very fatherly figure to, too. I mean, it was just, to scale the level of hurt that it caused across the board would be very difficult to sort of put a number on how many people did it, because it was just big.
Yeah.
And I think this is the warning with this, is that, you know, this is not just about being sexually pure. This is about protecting the people that God has put into your life and them looking out for and loving and cherishing you as well. Mm-hmm. And protecting relationships, and we've said even back when we did the fourth commandment or when we introduced the catechism that this is, you know, it was called the Layman's Bible in Germany. It was printed on poster boards, meant for parents, probably specifically fathers, to teach to their children and to hand down the faith in this way. Well, if the marriage is broken and the family is broken, that faith is much more difficult to hand down in the same way too.
Right.
And so there's just the tentacles of this are very long and reach very deep.
Yeah, that would be something covered in your book about the habits of children, the church going and handing down the faith, and sort of the family dynamic there. This can put an end to the family. And so,
and when we focus on it as just sexual purity, just kind of for the sake of sexual purity, that's not wrong. But at the same time, I think it's not as hard hitting as the destruction that this kind of thing can bring to many levels of people.
Well, this can help explain what the pitfalls of sexual immorality actually are. I think you can get stuck in talking about it as purity for purity's sake. And it's one thing because God commands it. It's another thing to see that God's commands are in part gifts for this life. And part of what that means is that there are benefits that aren't just God likes it, right?
Yeah, that's right. And that's what I sometimes hear it taught that way. And it's almost like you're not cheating or you're being for the sake of God.
Because it makes God happy.
Because it makes God happy.
And
whereas I'm sure that his preference is that you do stay that way and that your family does stay intact, he's pretty clear that your service to him is by serving other people.
Right.
And so the big concern is how does this affect other people?
Right. And I think some of the Old Testament, you know, heroes who committed adultery, Abraham and David, to just name a couple, right? The outfalling of that really does have to do with these other people that they harm, right? So, you know, Abraham sort of and Sarah like violate their relationship, and they cause like a dread for an entire another family, being Ishmael and his mom, right?
Yeah.
An exile, casting shame upon an entire another group of people, sort of, you know, causing turmoil there. And then a struggle for his own son then too, in that. And then same with David. It completely screws over all of his other kids.
Yep.
Changes the order of who's going to be king, affects all of Israel in that, and in the midst of that, gets somebody else killed for the sake of it.
Right.
And so, you know, it's those kind of show you that it isn't just a one-sided issue here.
Well, it also shows you that the sinning against God's commandments or sinning against other people by virtue of breaking these commandments, you don't end up just by sinning against by breaking one,
right?
You know,
well, yeah. When
look you at end the up example that you gave of David, you not only have adultery,
but
there,
you have murder.
You have murder. You have theft.
Covetousness.
I'm sure at some point you could say that this is not honoring his father at all.
Yeah, and it's because you end up seeing your neighbor as tools to ends, means to an end. So you leverage
means to your ends.
So you leverage them for different purposes.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So seventh commandment. Maybe even past adultery, one of the ones again where it's like, oh, I don't really steal, right? I don't shoplift. That's where my mind goes. It's like, well, when I go into the grocery store, I pay for everything in the cart,
right?
Or I haven't broken into my neighbor's house, and taken their stuff out,
Again, it's very easy to see this one dimensionally. It's very easy to see it as just physical theft from somebody else. Mm-hmm. Going, like you said, breaking into your neighbor's garage, taking the lawnmower, and never giving it back.
But as we read Luther's explanation, there's a little something about bad trade deals.
Yeah, I think this one is one of the more interesting explanations because Luther, it seems like, has some experience with being treated poorly.
Swindled a little bit. Yeah. So, you know, the explanation is we are to fear and love God so that we do not take our neighbor's money or property or acquire it by using, this translation says, shoddy merchandise or crooked deals.
That's funny.
But instead help them to improve and protect their property and income.
Shoddy merchandise or crooked deals. False ware or dealing in the old one.
Yeah, I do think there's a bit of irony to the fact that we highlighted last episode the one translation thing, and
we used to.
We've been using two or three, but
we could probably fix that.
We need a little. I need to just get on whatever version you're using because you're not going to change.
No, probably not.
Yeah. So, I think this one is a little interesting because deception as theft here, right? So, this would be like sort of lying about what you're selling somebody, maybe even in this case, underpaying,
representing that something is yours that belongs to somebody else.
Right.
I mean, there's lots of ways to break the seventh commandment, and we're all pretty good at finding ways to do it while saying that we're not doing it.
Drinking half the beer and saying, this isn't the beer I ordered.
Yeah. Right. There's all sorts of ways to do this, and people do it all the time. And beyond that, I think Luther's explanation here is, again, focusing on the fact that if you break this commandment, so let's say it this way. If you steal somebody else's money, you're obviously not affecting God.
Right.
Right? God doesn't need money. God doesn't deal in money.
No.
But if you steal somebody else's money or goods or reputation or intellectual property or whatever, you're stealing, you're harming them. And this is a neighbor of yours. This is somebody that God has, in one way or another, to one level or another, put into your life. Mm-hmm. And you are, again, using them for your own means.
Right.
And this is the warning here. And you do get the flip side of this again, where Luther's encouragement is not only to not steal from them, but to help them
right.
protect and preserve their property.
Yeah.
And so it changes it. Maybe we can all say, or maybe some people can say, well, I've never done any of those things that you guys mentioned as stealing. Well, the flip side of that, Luther says the breaking of this commandment includes the times when you don't help protect and preserve somebody else's wares or property. And again, if you think of how deep this kind of thing can go, it's actually pretty easy to misrepresent in some way, shape, or form, to take something that belongs to somebody else.
This one was a hard one when I worked at the car dealership.
Yeah, I bet.
This was...
car salesman.
Yeah, I mean, when I was working there and you're selling cars, you know that, and everybody knows this, but there is not a singular price that any car on a lot is worth. There's a range. There's what the dealer's asking, plus all the extras they think it's worth, plus some sort of bottom dollar that's only in the mind of the general manager or whoever does that at the dealership. And the people trying to buy the car are trying to figure out what that bottom dollar is. And you may be given that information at some point as a salesman. And I mean, at the end of the day, your job is to kind of make sure they don't figure that out. Right. At least at the dealership I worked at, maybe there are some that are less shady than that.
I don't think so.
Probably not. Now I kind of broke that a little bit a couple times. There were a couple times where, you know, there were people who I sort of, when a manager would leave the room, say, "Hey, you can get another $1,000 out of them." But
then are you stealing from your employer?
But then am I stealing from my employer? Right. Cause my job is to, make my employer
money. Yeah.
And so, yeah, so this was a difficult one, working at a place where prices were negotiable, and you have people who are probably sitting there and think they're being ripped off. Like, everybody who goes to a car dealership kind of feels like they're getting ripped off the second they're on the lot. And somebody who wants you to help rip them off, right? So that was an interesting phenomenon there about how do you navigate this kind of thing.
Yeah, that had to be I couldn't do it. So I'm not a good salesman though.
In the flip side, I've taken some of that knowledge.
I'm the guy that's like, "You like this car? You should buy it." That's about the extent of my sales.
On the flip side, I've taken some of that knowledge, and I've been able to help people buy cars and navigate dealerships since then.
Yeah.
Family and friends. I think in the last couple of years, I think I've probably helped over 10 people buy cars one way or another. But the way I acquired that knowledge probably involved a little bit of breaking the seventh.
Well, you know, it's hard. It's hard in situations like that to say, you know, whose obligation is it at that point to protect the customer? I mean, right, in that instance, you're employed by somebody who's telling you to do something. It's not like you're sitting there misrepresenting wares that belong to you. That's a tough one.
Yeah.
Probably if you want a clean conscience on the seventh.
Don't be a car salesman. Don't be a car salesman. All right. Well, good to know. Okay. So we can move on a little bit. We're going to just take one more step. The eighth commandment. This one makes me think about our comment on the fifth about the internet again here and social media, because I think this is probably the number one place where we outwardly break this now. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. And then Luther goes on to say, we are to fear and love God so that we not tell lies about our neighbor, betray or slander them, or destroy their reputation. Instead, we are to come to their defense, speak well of them, and interpret everything they do in the best possible light, which used to be put the best construction on everything, which is probably a much more catchy translation.
It's more catchy, but probably less understood these days than Wangert's translation there. Here's the thing with this is that this is encouraging you to do the thing that will be hardest for you to do, which will be accept what people say to you and about you with the best sort of light put on it, and to put the best light on what you say about other people and how you represent other people. This will be the hardest if you're trying to struggle here, if you're struggling through, like, hey, keeping the commandments, this will be the hardest one, because this is the easiest one for us to break, because it beyond coveting, but like outwardly, this is the easiest one to break because all it involves is us moving our mouth, and or typing on a keyboard, and or you don't have to go out and steal something. You don't have to actively misrepresent goods. You don't have to go find somebody to kill. You don't have to go find somebody to be sexually impure with. You just have to open your mouth and or not interpret what somebody else is saying about you or about your situation, about somebody you love, about your house or about your goods, or interpret that with sort of the best light put on it. And that is difficult.
Yeah. I mean, interpreting things as malicious
is our go-to.
Is the default.
Even with people that we love the most.
No,
and maybe especially with people that we love the most.
Yeah, absolutely. Catch myself doing that daily.
Oh, yeah, me too.
And so
I rarely take things that your mother say that annoys me and say, well, wait a minute.
She did that on accident.
She didn't mean to annoy me with that. That's rarely my go-to position.
Yeah. No, that's, I'd say the same. And now it is very easy to take your interpretation of the way things go and your reading of malice into things and start to mass disseminate that in other people's minds, right?
Yeah.
A couple strokes on a keyboard and press the little send button and you might be able to change hundreds, tens, hundreds, or thousands of people's minds about another individual.
Well, think about it this quickly. Way. In 15 years ago, I don't know when Facebook page was invented. I know I was late to the game and kind of early out, but let's say 10 years. How long has it been since Facebook's been around?
I have no clue.
It's been a minute. Before that, right, before the prevalence of social media, think about how hard it would have been in your daily life, just like your daily life, to say something bad about somebody else that affected them in their life in that day.
Professionally, personal relationships.
Professionally, personal relationships, publicly, or whatever. Think about how difficult it would have been to do that to somebody that's very far away from where you live. Now, it's easy to do to people in your house, to hurt their feelings, to make them feel like crap, to, you know, affect the way they're acting or doing X, Y, or Z by your words. But think about how hard it was to do that to multitudes of people, none of whom necessarily are in your own home, right, or in your sort of direct sphere of influence. And now it's easy. It's easy. And it's almost encouraged, because a lot of what happens now is that people speak bad about other people for the sake of, quote-unquote, correcting them, mm-hmm. to make them right, to make them more just, to make them more righteous, or to show them the error of their ways or something like that. Mm-hmm. But rarely is the best construction put on that correction, right?
Yes.
And or when correcting, is the best construction put on the thing that you think you're correcting?
Right.
And it's harmful. I mean, it's having worked in the student affairs at the university for many years, this is actually really harmful to people. This affects the way they live their day-to-day lives. It's their emotions, their feelings, their actions even. And it's...
Well, there's heightened...
it's a big warning for our time.
I mean, statistically, like, there's lots more cases of anxiety sort of, like, clinically as a... And sort of just people who polled say they're anxious. And I think a lot of it has to do with the amount of people monitoring the things you do at any given time. You know, because a large portions of your life are shared online, large portions of your life are shared with people in person who then can tell lots of other people, right? Like, there's just a huge net of people who are monitoring your behavior, your decisions, the way you live your life every day. And so, you know, the percentage of people out there who can interpret that in a way that makes you feel horrible or maybe even affects you is very high.
Yeah. Yeah. And bearing false witness, you know, doesn't always, it's not just courtroom stuff here. It's not just when there's a disagreement over something. It's actually just representing somebody in a way that doesn't defend them, their reputation, or build them up, but publicly besmirches who they are and what they said. And like I said, this is very easy in our day and age to get self-righteous about it under the guise of correcting some error on their part. But really, putting the best construction on everything means just that. That means to speak well of them, to defend them.
Yeah.
Whenever possible. And maybe if they need corrected, to do it personally and not publicly.
All right. So the 9th and 10th, which we sort of prefaced last episode, that there's, you know, like a strange ordering. And this is where that starts to become apparent, right?
Well, it's where it really becomes apparent, is because what you have here is admonition to not covet, which means to not desire what belongs to somebody else in such a way that it dramatically affects your life and maybe theirs.
Yeah.
I think when we recorded this last week, one of the things I pointed out was that the warning in this commandment is almost a personal warning to you, right? Saying to you that if you covet what belongs to somebody else, and it by covet, you got to get kind of like, you got to get into it. It's not just like, man, I really like that truck. It's like, I'd do almost anything to have what that guy has.
Yeah, it'd sure be a shame if something happened to you and I don't know. You'd have to give your truck to one of your children. And
I think Josh needs a work truck more.
Oh, no.
but, you know, to the point where you don't appreciate the things that you have in your own life. And that's the big thing, right, is that I don't appreciate the things that I have in my life. I only appreciate what it seems like the life the other guy has.
Yeah.
And the 9th and 10th commandment, as we have them in our ordering, they're kind of broken up into coveting the things in other people's lives in the 9th, and the people in other people's lives in the 10th.
Yeah.
Right? So, the 9th, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's house. Luther explains it and says, again, we should fear and love God, that we don't craftily seek to get our neighbor's inheritance or house, or obtain them by a show of, it says a show of right, but
yeah, this
it
is
means
like
legal, by a legal mechanism that shows you have some sort of
power
over their belongings.
Some escape clause in some contract. Yeah.
But help and be of service to him in keeping it. So again, you have both sides of that. You should serve your neighbor by helping him to keep what belongs to them, but at the same time, don't covet them. And the coveting, if you think about it, if you just sit here and covet what belongs to your neighbor and you don't do anything about it, you just covet it, it's not going to hurt. That's not going to really hurt you, that the guy that you're coveting. But it's going to hurt you
and the other people in your house.
And the other people in your house, because you're never going to be happy.
Right.
And so the warning here is kind of deep and extends. And what Luther's trying to do by saying help him keep his stuff is reframe your mindset a little bit. To say not only is it not appropriate for you to overlook all the gifts that God has put into your life and to only want the things that that person has, but step more than that, you're supposed to help them keep it.
Yeah. Yeah, right? That's been the theme, right? Here is your neighbor's going to have needs that go against sort of your base desires to take things from your neighbor, to use your neighbor to gain, to make your own life better by using your neighbor somehow, right? And
I think the the second warning here is that if you covet something enough, the temptation to then break the seventh commandment and go ahead and steal it.
Yeah.
Or when we get to the 10th commandment, to break the 10th commandment by desiring your neighbor's wife so much that you then have an affair with her and break the 6th commandment. Again, these are rarely broken alone. Mm-hmm. They're usually broken as a pack. Mm-hmm. Starting with coveting something so much that it becomes your God. Mm-hmm. Becomes that thing that you fear, love, and trust the most.
Right.
And therein break the first commandment.
Right.
And so these are all tangled together. They're meant for your good. They're meant for your neighbor's good. And there's one sure thing you know about them. One sure thing you know about every single one of these that you will break and have broken every single one.
Yeah.
Now, in acknowledging that, that's not saying that one ought not try to keep them, because, of course, that's the whole way that Luther frames this and ends it in the conclusion in kind of a scary way. But it means that this is the setup to Luther's ever developing law gospel theology here. And what you get here is you get the expectations on you that are for your protection. And you get the good side of it too, that are for your protection and for the protection of those who God has put into your life.
Right.
But you also get here the warning that breaking these commandments has consequences.
Yeah, very severe. We have a couple of minutes. I guess we could just read the closing sure. commandments. So here's what you mean by scary, right? What then does God say about all these commands? Answer, God says the following, I am the Lord your God, am a jealous God. Against those who hate me, I visit the sin of the fathers of the children up to the third and fourth generation. But I do good to those who love me and keep my commandments to the thousandth generation. Then Luther, what does this mean? God threatens to punish all who break the commandments. Therefore, we are to fear his wrath and not disobey these commandments. However, God promises grace and every good thing to all those who keep these commandments. Therefore, we also are to love and trust him gladly and act accordingly to these commands.
Yeah. So, one of the things I always think is interesting here is that he punishes those to the third and fourth generations, those that hate him.
Right.
And I've thought quite a bit about this part. And I think what's going on here is that, again, if you see the small catechism in the context of the layman's Bible and that this is what's being used to teach the layman the Christian faith, there's a big warning here that if you don't teach your children this Christian faith and hand down this faith, that sin is not just a sin against your own children, but it's going to be a sin against the generations of children that come after your children, because they then too won't be taught the faith.
Right.
And they'll be left not knowing God's commands, not knowing the Christian faith as expressed in the creed, not knowing his prayer, not knowing the benefits and the gifts of his sacraments. They won't know those things. They won't avail themselves of those gifts. And the punishment is a punishment, but at the same time, it's the natural consequence of the fact that they have not been handed down the goods.
Yeah, hating God means you're not going to hand down the faith, and that is not just you, but your children.
And not just your children.
Your children's children, their
children. But your grandchildren, your great-grandchildren, your great-great-grandchildren.
And that's a real reality.
That's a real reality. And we can see this in our lives.
Right.
Of people who have fallen out of the faith, not been handed down the faith, and now for generations have not raised their children in that same faith.
Right.
Now, there's a direct encouragement to keep these commandments, and that God blesses those who keep these commandments. That's certainly true. And you, again, as I said, as you get Luther's sort of ever-developing law gospel theology here, you get in this close of the commandments some pretty heavy-duty law.
Yeah, I think that's one of the real parts here is if we go back to the preface, and Luther says they do not know the Ten Commandments. Nobody is preaching to them God's law. In fact, he says some of these people understand some of these human-made laws about church,
right?
But they don't understand God's law. We then have to ask, what does Luther think God's law does? And here it reveals sin, it reveals God's wrath towards sinners, it reveals death and punishment, and it empowers death and punishment, according to Paul, right? And so this is sort of what the breaking of the law does. And I think very quickly you realize here, right before you go into the creed.
Yeah, where you're going to get the side of the gospel.
I mean, I think if you read through all 10 and you took them very seriously and you didn't sort of make them this checklist that we said where it's a pat on the back the whole time because you haven't killed somebody or broken into somebody's house recently, all this kind of stuff. But you took them very seriously and you read this, you kind of feel like you're on the punishment end of some of this, right?
Yeah.
And like you said, you're going to find that you've broken every single one of these at some point. We're actually now transitioning into the creed, which, you know, as we go on, Luther's going to explain what God's words to sinful creatures are.
Well, you're going to learn about God the Father and his creating and sustaining of every part of your life. You're going to learn about God the Redeemer, how nothing that you have said or done is what saved you, but it's Christ alone that saves you. And you're even going to learn about how you come and are kept in the faith by the power of the Holy Spirit, and how not even your coming to or staying in the faith is something that you do, but that God does for you.
Right. Yeah. You know, not by my own power or strength.
Yeah.
Is going to be.
I really like the old translation on that a lot better.
Yeah. So by next episode, we will just switch to the old translation. Yeah. I will change Book of Concords here shortly. So, well, guys, thank you for listening to this episode.
Sorry about the redo.
Sorry about the re-recording. Sorry for those who would have looked forward to having Rod on this episode. Unfortunate technical mistake. I'm just glad we were able to correct it in time. You can join us next week as we begin the creed. We will probably just, I don't know how far we'll get, but we'll at least get through the first article on creation. Thanks for listening to this episode. We'll catch you next time. Bye.